Welcome to the Critical Few Actions to Improve Your Business podcast. I'm John Downes and I'm here to help you cut through the overwhelm and prioritize what matters most to improve your business. Let's get started and discover the critical few actions that have the biggest impact. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Leanne Simpson, who is an expert in crisis leadership. She is the circuit breaker you need when your executive team finds itself in the thick of complexity and chaos. I've known Leanne since 2023, when we were both working with Jason Small's Risk Factor, which was featured in episode 35. And I was surrounded by the heads of emergency services, drought and flood relief, and other crisis experts. If there's been a major crisis in the state in the last 25 years, she's been involved in it. Leanne, welcome.
Thanks, John. It's really good to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to chew the fat a little bit about what I've done and what I'm doing now.
Fantastic. It's a privilege to talk with you about it. So, Leanne, today we're going to talk about how medium business founders and CEOs can use crisis leadership to improve business efficiency and profitability. But first, tell me a bit about your crisis leadership journey. How did you first get interested in it? And how did that journey evolve?
Yeah, thanks, John. So it was a little bit of a wild and woolly story. So I started out as a paramedic, actually, many years ago. And that taught me a lot of really great skills that have held me in good stead as I have worked through my career over the years. It set me up with some skills that allowed me to make good decisions on the fly in high-pressure situations. Moving on from that, when I decided to test my wings and in the real world, I stepped into the more corporate space. So I started moving across different areas of business, having gone into the state emergency service. And that was where I really cut my teeth on emergency management proper and also started to understand more about business and all the things that sit behind the frontline aspects that eventually evolved into more corporate roles and executive roles. And there was always a thread for me around risk and emergency crisis management and consequence management. So I was working in areas out and on issues that were complex, complicated, and had high consequence generally for the community at large.
Actually, it's interesting. Crisis, risk, and consequence management. We'll come back to that in a minute, but I hadn't thought of all three in the same context. So in the context of medium business, CEOs and founders think that getting up in the morning and looking at their phones is the start of a day in crisis leadership. But if that's the case, well, then that's a whole different leadership development opportunity. I'm talking about when things get seriously out of hand. And in this context, what do you see is crisis leadership, Leanne?
Well, crisis leadership really is when you're dealing with the things that fundamentally could take your business down. It's not the headline and the paper today that's going to cause you a bit of a nuisance, and upset your schedule to move to a plan B. It is the things that are literally going to impact your core and critical functions and quite seriously could actually put you out of business.
Yeah, well, crisis can mean a lot of things to different people, from workplace incidents, maiming or, God forbid, fatalities, to large-scale chemical spills or fires, floods, tempests, either in our four walls or that actually impact us from outside, even pandemics and major supply chain disruptions and so on. So today I want us to focus on a significant uncontrolled calamity. Now, you've been through not one, but many of them. Take me through how we should deal with them and then what it takes to lead through them.
Yeah, so gosh, how to deal with as a first point is really critical because time is of the essence. When you're thinking about what it is that you've got at hand, often in the context of scarcity of information, you'll be working with a lack of information, you'll be working with a lack of time, and you probably actually won't have the resources that you would ideally like to have to throw at the problem.
Mm-hmm. You're just in the thick of it.
With almost inevitable constraints, the first things that you need to do is get the right people around you and get them in early so that you've got that broader power of thinking. The second thing is clarifying what you do and don't know about the situation and doing that rapidly and getting comfortable with the fact that there'll be more information that comes to hand, but you can't wait for that. You actually have to start making some decisions and moving early. The third thing I should say that really is important is you do have to act. You need to start making decisions and taking actions. And one of those first actions that you need to take is starting to communicate. So you need to be communicating with people internally and externally about what you've got on your plate, what you're doing about it, and when they can next expect to hear from you. And that first communication might be as simple as, we've got this thing happening. We don't have all the details. We'll come back to you when we know more. We expect that to be in 3 hours.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, you talk about really a lack. You find yourself in a crisis situation, possibly one that you haven't experienced before. And the first things that you realize is that you don't have time to dally and to make perfect decisions. You won't necessarily have the right resources with you, and you need to amass those as best you can, because we don't have it's a crisis, therefore it's not a perfect environment by default. And you're never going to have sufficient information to make the perfect decision. So if that's the case, we're going to have to be comfortable that we're going to have to make decisions and take actions that are not as informed as we would like. And in fact, we also, I guess, need to recognize that we're probably going to be criticized for any decision we make because we're making it with a deficit of information, resource and time. And 2020 hindsight is just such a wonderful thing for everybody else after the event to deal with. So that sort of really resonates. And I think we can all relate to that to a degree. But I wonder if you can help take me through how a CEO could visualize this in the context of their businesses. Take me through your experience, perhaps, say, with the Royal Flying Doctor there, and how'd you approach it? Help me understand.
Yeah, so the situation I was dealing with then was what I describe as a creeping crisis.
Okay.
It's a slow burn in the background where there are a lot of signals that were there to tell a story about things are going wrong, but for whatever reason, they weren't acted
on. Okay, so what was actually going on?
Well, the crux of the matter really was cash flow.
Right.
Which a lot of your CEOs, I'm sure, can relate to. There was the part of the business that I was brought into, and the words were either fix it or shut it down. That part of the business had been built. It had grown really rapidly. It was delivering really good work. But there were a range of things sitting in the background that were making it increasingly complicated to run and increasingly difficult to maintain it as a viable proposition.
Right.
Mm.
Okay.
So what your CEOs, I think, would recognize in that as it's never just one thing. What was at play was changes in expectations from customers, changes in regulations. So for businesses generally, increasing levels of regulation is a real feature. Changes in workforce requirements and how you manage employees.
Yeah.
This was a business that had been built on a casualized workforce. And of course, there'd been a massive shift with how you can manage casuals in the workplace. And, so there was a need to adjust that. And also increasing competition. So that and a few other bits and pieces. It's complex, it's messy, it's tough, but you've also got some really great things in your favour as well. And it's an organisation that attracts people who really care about what they do.
Yeah.
It's a business that does good work and important work, necessary work in areas where services are hard to come by.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well worth solving.
Yeah. And I think this, it's also interesting that that's an environment where there's a lot of passion and emotion attached to the RFDS.
It's a brand. Everybody globally knows the Red Valley Plains out in the desert.
Yeah.
The Victorian base of work was deliberately quite different. The requirements for the types of services that you see in the outback, it's a different requirement here in Victoria. So the bulk of the work that was done here, and it continues to be done, is road-based.
Yeah.
And that suits the population, geographical footprint, all of those sorts of things. Yes, it's supplemented by paramedical as well, but primary service delivery was road-based ambulance.
Sure. So, as you said, this was a creeping crisis, possibly these factors that sort of built up over a decade or more. What was the trigger event that forced you to be involved in this process?
Well, I think they had persisted with a range of different approaches within the business, actually over quite a long period of time, and they got to the bottom of their toolbox.
Yeah.
So the business had been in play at that stage it was initiated about 15 years prior.
Yeah.
And it was probably, for like a lot of businesses, really that period through the pandemic and coming out of that, that really highlighted the challenge that they were facing. I think it would be fair to say that, again, 2020 hindsight, looking back, the decision to bring somebody in with a different line of thinking would have been better if it had been a little bit earlier. But you do, you work with what you've got and you make the best decision that you've got available to you at the time. I mean, that goes back to what I said earlier in the conversation. You're working with imperfect information. Even within an organization, there are certain things that don't all come together and paint the full picture without the right questions being asked.
Yeah. And so once they realized that they had ultimately a cash flow problem, which basically said that the business model was failing, what were the key impacts that you had to address?
Well, really, as I said before, this was a fix it or shut it down situation. And, that was something that has to be taken really, really seriously because there are contractual obligations to be met. There are communities to be served across the state. So the implications of getting it wrong are significant.
Yeah.
But time was of an essence as well. So really it was hitting the ground running, doing a rapid assessment of what we had, what we were working with, and making sure that there was a solid plan to really move the dial on all of it. And it wasn't to turn this around to make a profit. It was to turn this around to break even.
Yeah, to survive.
Yeah. And so that meant thinking radically differently around how the business could be delivered. And that meant thinking about organizational structure, the positioning of resources, the configuration of crewing, the way we would serve our clients. So essentially what was delivered and the impact was a completely new service delivery model and a completely new operating model.
Wow.
So there was a 12-week assessment period. I was pretty confident at the 6 or 7 week mark to go back to the CEO and board and say, yeah, we can fix this. And then, it was crafting a storyline and a vision of what it could look like and what it would take to actually get it there.
Yeah.
And then putting the wheels in motion to do that.
Absolutely. And I guess you know, as I've often seen before in organisations that are facing challenges or crises or looking to change things dynamically, you know, when you do that, there's often quite a bit of friction. It's probably the nicest way to put it. Tissue rejection is another word that comes to mind. Out and out resistance. You know, some bozo's been wheeled in to help me figure out how to do my job that I've been doing the right way for 30 years. And you know, so what were the leadership challenges and how did you get people on board with this? This wasn't an insignificant change. You've just described changing their business model, the way they actually interact with customers, the services they offer, the way they deliver those services, you know, so not exactly trivial topics.
No, and it's the sort of thing that a lot of organisations the one thing at a time and do it over significant periods of time as well. We didn't have that luxury.
No.
So, yeah, yes, there was resistance. And that came from a range of different directions. It came internally because we had a broader organisation that had seen a lot of resources thrown at this part of the business. So there was some scepticism there around whether or not this would make any difference or if it would just take more resources away from what they were doing for longer. So that was very real. We had a workforce, as you said, quite rightly, who have done things a particular way for a decent length of time and needed to be convinced that there was a different or better way. And then, of course, we had the hospitals and, you know, who were receiving these services, and they get the same model of service from all the agencies providing that service. And I've had that for, you know, more than a decade.
Yeah.
So why would they want anything any different? It serves their need.
And their business models was wrapped around it anyway. And change for them is as torturous as it is for most people.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the you call, well, they call, we call type model had been working for them.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a crass way of putting it, but essentially that was what was in place. And what I was proposing was a model that worked towards addressing actual service demand.
Right.
And so the engagement, it was showcasing what was possible to all of those groups, evidencing it with data and mapping what we could do differently and showing what the benefits were to them. So the benefits to the hospitals in terms of getting better response times to their calls, clustering service delivery so that it was mapped in a way across different hospitals to allow for an overall better service delivery within a geographical footprint. For our staff, it was showcasing the fact that we would be more considerate about how they were crewed, how they were rostered.
Yeah.
And that influenced the sorts of patients they cared for and ensured that they were aligned to the skill sets that they'd worked so hard to achieve. So, you know, for them, it led to an opportunity to actually be better satisfied in their day-to-day work.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess, you know, in any situation like this, you know, what gets measured gets managed. And, you know, I can see that from their customers' perspective, in specifically the hospitals and the healthcare providers, your ability to actually measure the benefits and the outcome improvements for them was probably an essential part of getting them on board.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was really interesting is those customers for this type of service, there really wasn't a lot of data available that they held. So what I was finding was what I was sharing and presenting to them was news to them and actually really helpful. So a lot of the hospitals, for example, have KPIs related to patient movement within the hospital. So we all know the terms about bed block and ramping, hospital ramping, et cetera, which is, you know, highlighted in the emergency patient transport space. But the non-emergency patient transport is part of that system. And the ability to move people out of the hospital environment is a really important measure.
Yeah.
And one of the hospitals where we piloted this program, they had a KPI of moving people out by midday.
Yeah.
They were sitting at 2 p.m. when we started, and within weeks, we moved the dial on that by 3 hours.
Yeah.
But so, you know, the flow-on effects of us doing better in the service provision as an organisation has huge flow-on effects for those customers as well, because every hour that they keep a patient in their environment longer than what it's required, you know, there's care provision, there's, you know, all the costs associated with holding people longer than they need to be, and the ability to actually bring more people through that
and serve the community,
need to be in the system as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's shift gears a little bit. So Leanne, you've been involved in another highly complex event in the Barwon region. That was quite different. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, well, the terminology, concurrent, cascading, compounding, those words are being used more and more frequently in relation to disaster events, particularly around natural hazards. So what I experienced when I was in Barwon South region was a range of different natural hazards that led to emergencies for the communities across the regional footprint that ranged from floods, fires, landslide, and just for fun, we threw in a supercell storm as well. So that was a really interesting time. That region is colloquially known as Sleepy Hollow. And for the period that I was down there, it certainly wasn't.
You had bushfires, floods, landslides, and a supercell storm to compound it and make it slightly more complex.
Yeah, a little bit more complex in a different way, but really relevant to business leaders today because, you know, let's face it, you know, nothing ever happens in isolation.
Yeah.
And this was a really, you know, probably a more extreme example of a whole lot of things all combining. But what it did for my team and the teams and the agencies that were supporting was it really stretched resources across a protracted length of time. And it was in the context where you're still trying to deliver business as usual as well. You've still got brigades to support. You've still got services to deliver. You've still got your ordinary business metrics while you're concurrently responding and to these external influences.
Wow. That is a dynamic situation. So how did you help resolve that? And what were the leadership learnings?
Yeah. So resolving it is about dealing with what's most important at that time.
And so when you've got all four of those things happening, either in sequence or together just for entertainment's sake, how do you actually prioritise?
Yeah, so with an emergency management there, and particularly here in Victoria, there's a really strong ethos around priorities.
Mm.
And first and foremost, it is primacy of life. So, you know, things become really simple when you get right back to basics in that way. So from a business context, the equivalency might be the survival of your business. Is this thing going to knock your business out? As a leader, it's about having your eye on that, but also having being conscious of what's going on in the background and what else needs to keep ticking along. So critical function, core functions in the background, and you are getting right down to what needed to do, not what's nice anymore. So prioritization is important. I referenced the emergency management priorities before. The second one on the list is communication, timely, tailored, relevant. Is the trio. And again, in this setting, It was communication with my staff and volunteers, being clear on what the priorities were and giving them permission to stop certain things as well. I think that's something that gets forgotten a lot. And, you know, everybody thinks that you've got to do all the thing, even when it is really crunchy. Actually, it's really important to say, no, we're going to do this, not that.
Yeah.
But you've got to have clarity about that before you get there. So that it is quick, it's clear, there's no ambiguity. People know exactly what they're directing their energy at. And then also it's about, you know, continuing to adapt across the time. So as a leader, it's knowing when to delegate, when to step back, when to change your direction and focus on the next thing and hand things off.
Yeah.
Because you can't keep doing all the things all the time.
No. Look, there's so many questions that sort of comes just from that series of paragraphs. I guess, you know, one of the things is, you know, delegation in a crisis situation is an essential tactic and skill. But I guess also, you know, with delegation comes an expectation of a certain level of performance. And the people that you delegate to, you're often not having the luxury of being able to choose because they're the best, they're the most capable, they're the, you know, the reality is one of their selection criteria is they happen to exist and they happen to be in front of you. And so how do you handle and manage or support their performance in that regard, for example?
I think there's two points I'll make on that. The first is that within the emergency services and military, I think most people are familiar with the concept of command and control.
Yep.
So there is a place for that in the early stages of a crisis, where as a leader, you need to step up and provide direction and clear direction for people so that they can come together and organize effectively. And that's the first thing. The second thing, you've essentially spoken about working with what you've got in terms of resources. The emergency services have a real advantage in that people are trained to do particular things. So we call them functional roles. They switch from their business as usual environment to a functional role. And we have an understanding of within the environment of who has those skills and where you can place them to get best effect. So within a business as a leader, what you need to be on the lookout for is, well, actually, I'll take a step back. The first thing you need to consider is who will you need around you when things are going to get crunchy? And where can you draw that from within your organization? And oftentimes, it's not your standard executive. It is sometimes somebody else or, you know, a couple of different people who wouldn't normally sit around that leadership table.
Yeah.
But they bring a different skill set that is super, super helpful when things get difficult. So identifying who you've got in the broader organization that can assist you in getting the best effect given the circumstance you've got at hand. And something that I continue to be encouraged by is the depth of experience that organizations do have.
Yeah.
The challenge sometimes is just uncovering that and understanding how you can use it in a different way, but then also enabling it to be impactful in that different context. So what I mean by that is your traditional organizational structure for your BAU work has authority and delegation attached to it.
Yeah.
You actually might want to shake that up a little bit in a crisis and hand authority and delegation or distribute authority and delegation in a slightly different way to get the best effect.
Yeah.
It's not turning that on forever, but turning it on for a specific problem that you're trying to solve or a crisis that you're working through can make sense.
And, you know, that's in business, that's quite common that, you know, when we're looking at addressing a problem or a challenge or a real opportunity, getting a variety of people in the room or temporarily on the team to look at it, digest it, dissect it, and try and figure out a way forward. having that diversity, whether it's of skill set, experience, perspective on the problem, regardless of gender and all those other diversity sort of metrics, you know, that's actually what provides a richer and often a far better informed decision-making process.
Absolutely. And you know, to take that the step further, you need those individuals empowered to actually act.
Yeah.
So they need the delegation to do the thing.
Yeah. So they need to be consciously and explicitly given permission.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you looking to pinpoint the areas that will make the biggest impact on your business? Check out the Organization Performance and Value Diagnostic. This powerful tool lets you evaluate your business on multiple facets and provides email reminders to keep you on track. Head over to criticalfewactions.com.au and get started now. And so when we're dealing with a crisis as a leader, you know, one of the things that you said earlier on was, you know, we're not going to have time, resource or information that we desire, and we need to be able to ruthlessly prioritise. Do you see these as learnable or even rehearsable skills?
Yeah, I do.
And how does that work in business?
It comes down to people being willing to invest the time to practice it.
Yeah.
And there's practicing it as an individual and practicing it as a team.
Take me through for instance.
For instance. So as an individual leader, thinking about how you might apply the discipline of building your leadership muscle for crisis really comes down to looking at the opportunities that are in front of you on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier in the conversation that habit that most leaders have of checking the headlines to see what's going to come across your desk. It's a really good place to start. That stuff, 9 times out of 10, isn't going to turn your whole week on end, but it gives you a good opportunity to think about the questions that you might ask if it were to overflow into your business.
Mm.
So thinking about, do I have enough? If that was happening with my business, do I have enough information to take a first step? Yes or no?
Yeah.
If it's a no, what information do I need to fill that gap?
Yeah.
And extending thinking related to you know, what is the worst that could actually happen? One thing that I've heard said more than once around disaster and crises, that the plan is that the planning that was attached to it often wasn't big enough in terms of imagination. You have to think bigger. It's, you know, I think Australians and Kiwis generally quite optimistic and tend to think it won't be that bad, but ask the question, what if it was? So, yeah, I think taking those daily opportunities to just look at things a little bit differently, open your mind up to the possibility of it all going horribly wrong.
Mm.
And then, you know, what have you got or have you not got that can help you work through that? In terms of, you know, addressing this and building the muscle as a team, again, it's practice.
Mm.
You put it on the agenda once a quarter even to discuss something that you are seeing in the sector elsewhere that could reasonably apply to your business. And take 20 minutes even just to check whether or not your current risk management settings are right, because they might need a little bit of an adjustment, whether or not you've got the resources readily available to support you if that were to happen in your context. And if not, well, you know, what options have you got available? Are you going to establish an SLA to have a really great crisis communicator come in and support you on the fly? Or are you going to bring in a specialized resource to stand along your executive team to provide a different perspective to support the decision-making and decision-making as well. Have an agreed framework to play with and test these scenarios over time. Practice it, have the right people in the room, get comfortable with inviting others into the room.
Yeah. Yeah, look, you know, the mind starts racing. You know, over the weekend there were two factory fires where a whole bunch of exotic cars went up in flames.
Yes.
Suspected arson attack, and I've got no better information on it. When I looked at the news reports on it, I wasn't particularly interested in the fire as such. Great that nobody was hurt. What I was thinking about was the factory next door that lost part of its factory wall because the fire was so hot that the best the fires could do was to try and contain the blaze within the area of confinement and minimise the risk to the neighbours. And so I looked at that the factory that was adjoining and thinking about what level of impact that was going to have on their business. It was effectively going to shut them down immediately. And what would be their ability to recover from that unforeseen event that, you know, half of their factory wall was missing, exposed. There'd no doubt be fire damage, smoke damage, water damage, and also a factory that was probably declared unsafe to inhabit anyway. So, you know, it's not just the crisis that you see. It's actually the crisis that you might be a neighbour of or that you might be affected of as a downstream thing. And, of course, all of us have had that experience in the last 5 years as being the innocent participants in, say, a global pandemic. So when I think about this from a medium business perspective, you know, developing these skills, thinking about it from a rehearsal perspective, thinking about it from a who should be on my team, thinking about it from is my risk profile and my risk assessments appropriate. Do you see this as just a CEO thing?
No, I don't. Look, I genuinely think that every leader has a role to play. And in fact, if you empower your staff, every staff member has a role to play in observing what's going on in the environment and looking for the signals. You know, oftentimes it's those who are closest to an issue that will be best placed to realise something's going awry and they need to have the mechanisms in place to notify and escalate. And we saw that just with the recent Optus outage. You know, there was an issue identified, reported in at a point in time, and it stopped and didn't generate the response that was required in that immediate moment. So there's an opportunity lost.
Yeah.
That helps you pick up on those sorts of issues in the moment. It's supporting leaders to be doing that environmental scanning and looking up and what is going on more broadly in the sector and beyond is also really important. A feature of my career was moving around different sectors, moving around different roles. So that gave me a really good knack for doing that environmental scan, understanding how it applied in this setting and how it might translate into another.
Yeah.
So building that muscle, I think, is super important and worth considering as an individual within an organization as you're coming up through the ranks. Because again, the more you practice it, the better you get at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The ability to observe and connect the dots with what is happening in one place and how it might reasonably relate is actually really powerful. And we do it in business with benchmarking all the time. So we do it for the good stuff, but it doesn't come as naturally to do it for the stuff that might cause.
Yeah.
But it's a super powerful thing to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, this is one of the processes that's implicit in strategic planning. You know, certainly, you know, when I take people through this in our CEO masterclasses, you know, we do consciously an environmental scan, not just of what the industry trends and the challenges that our industry is facing, but also what's actually happening to our environment, to our supply chain and beyond. also how our customers are being affected by changes in either the economy or in their demand profiles. And that's an essential thing that, you know, I think needs to be looked at on an annual basis. So when I'm thinking about dealing with a crisis, Leanne, what are the gotchas that I probably need to look for or look out for? I imagine there's thousands of them, but what would be the top two or three?
The first one that comes to mind is thinking that you're going to have a plan for it.
Yeah.
So organizations have gotten better over time with having plans for incidents and emergencies.
Mm-hmm.
But crises, by their very nature, come with uncertainty, and you know, have elements to them that haven't been previously considered. So a plan is great. A plan is important. A plan should be there, but it's the starting point. It's not something to stick rigidly to.
Yeah.
You have to, it's a plan is the opportunity to hit the ground running. Then you need to think on your feet.
Yeah.
I think the next thing is really about silos, recognizing them within the business and within the external environment that you're dealing with as well, and how you can address them and start information shared effectively across them.
So that's primarily an information and a communication issue?
Always. You look at every Royal Commission review of major significance that has happened in the last 30 years, the number one thing is communication, information sharing.
Mm.
And I was talking to somebody just in the last week or so who is in a really large organization that has recognized silos. They exist for really good BAU reasons.
Yeah.
But they can be really unhelpful in a crisis.
Yeah.
So being across that, aware of it, and you know, addressing it is important. And I think the last thing for me, and you know, this is based on hard-won experience, is recognizing the fatigue that comes with this, with dealing with a crisis. Mm. It's not something that you're going to fix in the next 4 hours. It is something that is going to take days, weeks, even months to work through.
Yeah, they're long-tail events.
Yeah, long-tail events. And there will be unintended consequences. There will be unanticipated consequences. So setting yourself up from the outset to sustain yourself as a leader and manage your own energy and effectiveness, as well as that of the people around you, is really important. And putting those measures in place to support that from the onset is really important. What I've seen time and time again is the thing happens, you'll get a 24-hour all hands on deck, and then there's nobody to take over. So again, having a plan around how you manage resources, how you share the load, how you chop people out to rest and reset. There's a bit of a misconception that resilience is built by doing all of these things, but it's not. The resilience comes in the same way as it does if you're doing a workout in the gym. The resilience is built when you're resting.
Yes.
That is where you get the chance to recover and come back fresh with the energy and
priority,
insight to be able to address whatever it is at hand by being fully present.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's that clarity that is going to help you make better decisions based on imperfect information, lack of time and lack of resources.
Yeah, you've got to be switched on.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you really want to kick off your strategic planning and work in a supportive environment with other CEOs and leaders, the CEO Masterclass in Strategic Planning and Implementation is for you. This 10-month small group course helps you craft your strategic plan, present it to a group of peer investors, and develop a habit of monthly implementation. Our waitlist is open now at criticalfewactions.com.au.
So, Leanne, if a founder or a CEO is looking to start utilising crisis leadership in their organisation consciously, What critical few actions should they start tomorrow if they did nothing else?
Well, I think mapping what their critical functions and where their dependencies are. So both upstream and downstream dependencies. So that's really getting a clear picture on what your risk profile is. That's number one. Number two, know what you've got in hand that can support you. So review your insurance. Does it cover all the things that it needs to cover? Force majeure, cyber attack. You know, does it give you capacity to cover staffing gaps, backfill teams? Because some policies these days do allow you to bring in resources to address a crisis situation. Really simple one, and it goes back to that priority two of the emergency management priorities. Map your stakeholder list.
So you
make
know who
sure
to communicate
that
to.
It is up to date, that the contacts are accurate, and really think hard about whether it is fulsome, because what we're seeing more and more today is your formal stakeholders are the ones that are going to cause you grief.
Mm-hmm.
It's those informal stakeholders that exist and the power of that collective voice that really needs to be considered as well.
Mm-hmm.
Understand what your redundancies are, and that can be redundancies in terms of rollbacks. It can be redundancies in terms of, you know, functional things like generators.
Supply chains,
absolutely. And redundancies in terms of activating an SLA that's in place to fill a gap that you've previously identified that you can't carry within your business under normal circumstances, but you recognise is absolutely needed in the event of a crisis. And I think the big one is you really need to understand what your window of tolerance is and what the triggers are.
What do you mean by that? The window of tolerance. Tell me a bit more about that.
Yeah. So how much time have you got up your sleeve before things get really crunchy? So you deliver a service to the community, say, or you deliver a product. How long can you actually have your systems down before you've reached the point of no return?
Yeah.
Is it hours? Is it days? It might be a week. Big industries in the state, if they lose power, there's a window of opportunity to get that reset before there's really significant consequences in their manufacturing system.
Yeah.
So understanding what that window is and working to it is hugely important.
Yeah. Fantastic. Thank you for just the wealth of information, insight and experience that you've brought to our conversation. I think it'd be really helpful if we can incorporate into our ebook some of those checklists and insights. Because just listening to this episode alone won't be enough to allow people to remember it as they're folding the washing or driving to Ballarat. I think that would be fantastic. Leanne, this has been a delightful chat. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it, and I've learned so much from it.
Thank you, John. It was an absolute pleasure.
Fantastic.
Thanks for listening to the Critical Few Actions podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and grab the downloadables from the show notes. And if you found this episode helpful, I'd really appreciate it if you share it with your peers and your team. Stay focused and take action. The Critical Few Actions podcast, including show notes and links, provides general information only and is not individualised business advice, nor can it be relied upon as such. You must take responsibility for your own advice, decisions, and actions.